the face and in the groove, tech tales and funding blaze. Welcome to Startup Jazz. Startup Jazz.
And we are back. Welcome, everyone, to episode 3 of Startup Jazz, the show where we break down the strategies, the stories, and the structural shifts shaping the startup ecosystem. I'm your host, George.
And I'm Michelle. It is so good to be back in the studio with you, George. My week has been a whirlwind of pitch decks and diligence calls, so I am more than ready to zoom out and find the melody in all this beautiful chaos.
The melody in the chaos. I love that. It's the perfect theme for today's jam-packed episode. We're covering the entire startup lifecycle today, from the founder's inner journey to the harsh realities of the public markets.
It's a big one. We're starting with the human architecture, a fascinating piece on what a founder does after the build. Then we'll get into the corporate architecture, why legal strategy is the new secret weapon for startups.
Exactly. And from there, we'll zoom out to the entire market landscape, breaking down the Q3 venture capital numbers. It's a tale of two markets, an unprecedented boom in AI and a quiet crisis for almost everyone else.
And against that backdrop, we're diving deep into three companies navigating this world in very different ways. We've got Archie, the vertical SaaS darling, quietly disrupting the dental industry.
Then we'll look at the complete opposite, Whatnot, the live commerce rocket ship that's all about hypergrowth and creating a new category of shoppertainment.
And to finish, we'll break down the long, complicated journey of Navan, formerly TripActions, and its rocky, long-awaited IPO. It's a masterclass in resilience, pivots, and the challenges of late-stage growth.
We've got the founder's soul, the company's skeleton, the market's mood, and the messy reality of execution. It's a huge episode, so let's get right into it. We'll start with Sasha Orloff and the art of the graceful exit.
Okay, so this first round review article, I asked 100 founders, CEOs, and VCs about career transitions, is just packed with wisdom. It centers on Sasha Orloff. For those who don't know, he co-founded LendUp, a fintech company aimed at being a better alternative to payday loans. This wasn't a small operation. The article notes he grew it to 250 employees and raised a $50 million Series C. By all external metrics, he was living the founder's dream.
He was. He had done everything you're supposed to do, and that's what makes his story so compelling. He wasn't forced out, the company wasn't failing. He hit a point of success and realized, maybe this isn't the job for me anymore. The article talks about the intense pressure on founders to follow the Bezos or Benioff script, to stay at the helm from garage to IPO and beyond.
Right, that's the modern mythology. But Orloff points out that for every Bezos, there's a Reid Hoffman at LinkedIn or a Larry and Sergey at Google who recognized when it was time to bring in a different type of leader. He makes this absolutely brilliant distinction that I think every founder needs to hear between the role of a founder and the role of a CEO. In the early days, they're one and the same, but as a company matures, they diverge dramatically.
This is the core of it. Let's break that down because it's such a critical framework. Orloff defines the two roles along two axes, responsibility and risk. As a founder, your responsibility is to solve a problem and find product market fit. You're the creator, the visionary. As a CEO of a 250-person company, your primary responsibility becomes fiduciary to the shareholders. You're allocating capital, managing a board, thinking about quarterly returns. It's a manager's job.
And the risk profile is completely different. The founder has an enormous appetite for risk. You're placing huge, potentially company-ending bets on an idea. You have to be, as the article says, exhilarated by that. But the CEO of a successful, scaled company, you can't make those same wild gambles anymore. You have something to lose: employees' livelihoods, investors' capital, customer trust. You have to be more careful, more methodical.
Exactly. Orloff's insight is that people and companies scale at different rates. I want to repeat that. People and companies scale at different rates. His company had reached a point where it needed a professional, careful CEO more than it needed an innovative, risk-taking founder. And he had the self-awareness to recognize that the skills and passions that made him great at starting LendUp were not the same skills and passions required to run it in its next phase.
It's profound self-awareness, and it's so countercultural. Most founders would see that divergence and think, okay, I need to change myself to fit what the company needs. And the article does offer advice for that path. Orloff strongly recommends getting a career coach. He tells this amazing story about being at a Y Combinator session with 24 other growth stage founders. And the speaker, Ali Rogani, asks who has a coach. Every single hand went up except his.
I must have missed that day of founder class. I love that line. It demystifies the whole thing. Great leaders get help. He talks about how his coach helped him learn a specific CEO skill that he didn't have as a founder, how to manage career executives. When you're a startup, your team is a ragtag gang of highly talented misfits. But when you scale, you hire C-level execs with 20 years of experience. Managing them is a completely different ballgame.
But even with a coach, the core question remains, do you want this new job? And Orloff provides this fantastic litmus test for other founders. He lists several inflection points where a founding CEO should take their emotional temperature and ask themselves if they're still excited about the work.
Let's list them because they're so practical. He says to check in with yourself, 1, when you start managing managers, 2, when the company forms a board, usually after the Series A, 3, when you're no longer in control of the board, 4, when you're cash flow positive, and when you're actively planning the IPO. At each of these stages, the job changes. The governance, the delegation, the pressure, it all shifts. If you find yourself consistently frustrated or unhappy at these milestones, he says it's time to start a conversation with your board.
It's such empowering advice. It reframes stepping down not as a failure, but as a strategic decision that's better for you, your shareholders, and your customers. You're bringing in someone who is genuinely excited about that specific job.
So he makes the decision. And the next part of the article is just as valuable, how to manage the transition. This isn't something you just drop on a Friday afternoon. He calls for an excess of intentionality because a founder leaving carries so much more emotional weight than a hired CEO departing.
He gives a step-by-step guide. First, plan the rollout for weeks. He worked with his co-founder, the board, and the head of comms for 6 weeks to get the messaging right. Second, give people space to process. They announced it on a Wednesday. He did a Q&A that day, another anonymous Q&A on Thursday, and a happy hour on Friday. It wasn't a rip the Band-Aid off moment. It was a process.
And the third step is my favorite. Be a human about it. He was planning to send a formal email, but instead read it at an all-hands meeting and just started crying. He got choked up. And he says someone had reminded him this isn't a time to be stoic. That vulnerability is what creates trust. It shows you still care, even as you're leaving. He even wore his LendUp C-shirt to the farewell happy hour to signal he was still part of the family as a board member.
It's a masterclass in compassionate leadership. Okay, so he's out. And this is where the free fall begins. He looks at his calendar, which for 7 years was booked in 15-minute increments, and it's just blank. He says, you don't just Google, what should I do after leaving the company I built?
Right. So much of a founder's identity is their company. The article says you almost have to redefine yourself. But he structured his time off. This wasn't just a long vacation. First, he did a 14-day full digital detox. No email, no phone. He needed to create distance to gain perspective.
Then he gave himself a framework. He mentions William Bridges' book Transitions, which is a classic, and he set learning goals. A professional goal, take courses on corporate finance and board governance, things he wished he was stronger at as a CEO. And a personal goal, learn to play tennis. He was reactivating his beginner's mind.
And of course, the big one, the 100 coffee chats. After his initial 100-day reset period, he started activating his network. He had a ton of inbound interest from his LinkedIn post announcing his departure. He just started saying yes to everyone.
Eventually, he got more strategic. He focused on 3 groups. 1, inbound contacts, just friends and colleagues. 2, operators who had been in his shoes, other founding CEOs who had transitioned out, and 3, investors, specifically his own VCs, because they have that 30,000-foot view of the market and have seen this movie play out many times.
And the wisdom he gleaned is fantastic. First big takeaway, he wasn't alone. So many other ex-founders told him, "Welcome to the club. What you did was not only common, it was smart." It normalized the experience and helped him internalize that he hadn't failed.
The second big takeaway was about the sophomore slump. This is the deep-seated fear that your next thing will never be as successful as your first. It's incredibly common. But the founders and VCs he spoke to reframed it for him. They said, "You're starting from a position of immense strength now. You have the skills, the network, the know-how. You are objectively more likely to be successful the second time around. It's about turning that anxiety into motivating energy."
Okay, so this brings us to the final part of his journey in the article, how to actually decide what to do next. He kept asking people, "How do you know when you're ready to come back?" And everyone gave him the frustratingly vague answer, "You just know."
Which is true, but not helpful. He found that for him, and for most people he talked to, the magic number was about 6 months. After 6 months, the feeling shifted from exhaustion to excitement when he thought about new opportunities. That was his signal.
And to channel that excitement, he used a few frameworks. The first one was identifying the 5 common pathways for a founder after their first startup. This is gold. They are, 1, become a repeat founder, start from scratch again, 2, become an investor, sit on the other side of the table, 3, become an expert in residence at a VC firm, a sort of middle ground where you advise and incubate ideas without the full commitment of being a VC partner, 4, work at a large company, like an Uber or Airbnb, for stability and large-scale problems, 5, join a fast-growing startup as the number 2, a COO or president role where you can apply your scaling experience without being the ultimate parent.
I love that parent versus babysitter analogy he uses. As a founder, the startup is your baby. As a number 2, you can be more of an objective, less emotionally attached leader. It's a different muscle to flex. He also shares a couple of personal frameworks for ideation. 1 is the Japanese concept of ikigai, which is the intersection of what you love, what you're good at, what the world needs, and what you can be paid for. It's a holistic model for finding purpose.
But he found that a bit too open-ended. The one that was most practical for him was a simple 3-list method. Make a list of 1, skills you want to build, 2, industries you want to work in or experiences you want to have, 3, your non-negotiables. Once you have that, you can craft a single sentence. "I'm interested in exploring role X in industry Y, and my must-haves are Z." That clarity makes it so much easier for your network to actually help you.
It's a brilliant, comprehensive look at a journey we need to talk about more. The final takeaway on the article is so powerful. Founders, you are not your startup. It's so easy to fuse your identity with your company, but there was a life before it, and there will be a rich and fulfilling life after it. Sasha Orloff's story is a roadmap for navigating that after.
A fantastic summary, George. It really is about building a sustainable personal architecture for a long and varied career, which in a way is a perfect segue. From the internal architecture of a founder's life, let's shift to the external, structural architecture of the company itself. Let's talk about regulation and why it's become the new secret weapon.
All right. Our second piece is from Crunchbase News, written by Aaron Solomon, and the headline says it all. Regulation as Alpha, why the smartest startups now build legal strategy into their DNA. Alpha, for our listeners who aren't deep in the finance world, means an edge, a way to generate returns that outperform the market. The argument here is that in 2025, compliance is a source of alpha.
This piece resonated with me so much because it captures a massive shift in the venture and startup landscape. The old ethos, famously from Facebook, was move fast and break things. And for a while, that worked. You'd build a product, get massive traction, and then, if you got big enough, you'd deal with the regulators. You'd pay the fines, hire the lobbyists, and sort it out later. That era is over.
It's completely over. The landscape is littered with the ghosts of companies that learned this the hard way. Think about the early days of ride-sharing, the crypto exchanges that blew up, the buy-now-pay-later fintechs that ran into consumer protection laws. Investors got burned, and now they're asking different questions. It's no longer just what's your TAM, it's what's your regulatory runway.
The article makes the point that regulation has become a moat. When you build your product around KYC, AML, data protection, or licensing requirements from the very beginning, you're not just avoiding future fines. You are building a barrier to entry that makes it incredibly difficult for competitors to follow you.
Let's look at the examples the article gives because they're perfect. Take Stripe. Stripe didn't just build a cool API for payments. They invested heavily early on in becoming PCI Level 1 compliant, which is the highest level of payment security. They went through the grueling process of getting money transmitter licenses in multiple jurisdictions. Was that slow and expensive? Absolutely. But what did it enable? It enabled them to become the trusted backbone for companies like Apple Pay, Shopify, and even Amazon. Their competitors, who tried to cut corners, could never achieve that level of trust and integration. The regulation was the product feature.
The Coinbase example is just as stark. In the wild west of early crypto, Coinbase was methodically collecting state-by-state money transmitter licenses and got New York's notoriously difficult BIT license way back in 2017. While other exchanges were operating in gray areas, Coinbase was building a fortress of compliance. When the regulatory winter came, who survived and was able to go public? Coinbase. Their S-1 filing is filled with references to their licensing and compliance as a core business asset.
And it's not just fintech. Look at Lemonade and InsurTech. Insurance is regulated state by state. It's a nightmare. Instead of trying to find a clever loophole, Lemonade hired veteran insurance executives from day one and did the hard work of getting licensed in all 50 states. That operational slog became their moat. A new startup can't just copy their app. They have to spend years and millions of dollars replicating that regulatory footprint.
This leads to another key concept in the article, the rise of the legal engineer. This isn't your traditional lawyer who reviews contracts after the fact. This is a new breed of professional, often a hybrid product manager and legal expert, who embeds compliance directly into the product. The law becomes part of the code.
Carta is a great example of this. They don't just give you software to manage your cap table. The software has built-in tools for securities law compliance. It helps you with things like 409A valuations and SEC filings. The compliance isn't an add-on. It's a core feature you're paying for. Plaid is another one. With all the new rules around open banking and data privacy, Plaid built consent capture and data transparency messaging directly into their API stack. They are anticipating the rules and productizing the solution.
And the article correctly points out that this is happening at hyper speed in AI. The smartest AI founders aren't waiting for regulation to happen. They are hiring general counsels on day one. They are building their models with data-proven audit trails and fairness frameworks from the ground up because they know a wave of regulation is coming and they want to be on the right side of it when it hits. The battle, as the author says, is now regulatory architecture versus regulatory architecture.
And investors are absolutely eating this up. The article cites some huge numbers. The global market for governance, risk, and compliance is already around $80 billion and projected to hit $120 billion. RegTech as a sector is exploding, expected to be over $70 billion by 2030. The money is flowing to the startups that solve these hard, boring problems. A founder who can walk into a pitch meeting and demonstrate a deep product-level understanding of their regulatory landscape has a massive valuation edge over one who hand-waves it away as something they'll hire a lawyer for later.
It's because the risk profile has changed. VCs now understand that regulatory risk isn't a peripheral risk. It can be an existential one. A single enforcement action can wipe out a company. So a startup that has de-risked itself on the regulatory front is fundamentally more valuable. The article mentions legal tech funding hitting a record $2.4 billion this year. That's not a coincidence.
So the big picture takeaway is this powerful reframing. The author says we're moving to a world where regulation isn't a ceiling, it's scaffolding. I love that metaphor. It's not something that holds you down. It's the structure that allows you to build higher and more safely than anyone else.
It applies across the board. In climate tech, the winners will be the companies that master the complex, evolving rules around carbon credits and ESG disclosures. In AI, it'll be the ones who build for transparency and fairness before they're forced to. In fintech, the game was already won by the companies that mastered licensing and compliance years ago. They are now the infrastructure everyone else builds on.
The closing line of the article is just perfect. The next wave of unicorns won't just have better tech, they'll have truly, infinitely better legal DNA. It's a fundamental change in the startup playbook. You don't just disrupt a market anymore, you help write the rules for the new market you're creating.
It's the brilliant synthesis of where we are now, and I love how it connects back to our first segment. Sasha Orloff's story was about intentional, long-term thinking for a founder's career. This piece is about intentional, long-term thinking for a company's foundation. Both stories reject the short-term, growth-at-all-costs mentality in favor of building something durable, defensible, and sustainable. Whether it's your own mental health or your company's legal standing, the architecture matters.
That's a perfect way to tie it all together, Michelle. It's the inner game and the outer game of building something meaningful. And on that note, we're going to pause for a moment. When we come back, we're shifting from individual company strategy to the entire market landscape. We'll break down the Q3 venture numbers and what they mean for founders everywhere. Stick with us. You're listening to Startup Jazz.
And we're back on Startup Jazz. Before the break, we were talking about building durable companies. Now we're zooming out to look at the health of the entire ecosystem based on the latest Q3 2025 venture funding data from Crunchbase. The headline number is big, $97 billion in global venture funding. It feels like the capital spigots are open again after the chill of 22 and 23. But Michelle, reading the fine print on this recovery tells a very, very different story.
It really does, George. It's like looking at a restaurant that's completely packed, looks like it's the hottest spot in town. But then you realize 90% of the people are all sitting at one giant table in the middle of the room, and the rest of the tables are empty. The party is happening, but the guest list is incredibly exclusive. This isn't the 2021 free-for-all. This is a targeted, concentrated, and frankly, top-heavy boom. That is the perfect analogy. And that giant table, of course, has a big neon sign above it that just says AI. Let's dive into our first major theme from this Crunchbase data, which is really the engine driving this entire market, the AI mega round phenomenon. The numbers here are just staggering.
They're hard to even get your head around. The first chart from the report shows that nearly half, 46% of all global startup funding in Q3 went to AI companies, almost one out of every dollars.
And it gets even more concentrated. The report notes that almost a third of that total, a third of the entire global venture funding, went to a single company. Anthropic raised $13 billion last quarter.
$13 billion in 90 days for one company. Let that sink in. That's more than the entire venture ecosystem of most countries raises in a year. It's more than the entire biotech sector raised in the US. It's a number that fundamentally changes the scale of what we consider venture capital.
It completely warps the landscape, and this is the perfect entry point to talk about the mega round. For our listeners, that's a funding round of $100 million or more. These used to be rare, celebratory events. Now, they are the market. The data shows a record-breaking 60% of all global venture capital and an even more astonishing 70% in the U.S. went into these 100 million-plus rounds.
So 7 out of every $10 invested in the U.S. went to an already large late-stage company. That is a massive shift, and it's the key difference between now and the last peak in 2021. Back then, as the Crunchbase piece points out, the money was flowing everywhere. You had food tech, health tech, fintech, crypto, e-commerce. Everyone was getting funded, from pre-seed to pre-IPO. It was a broad, if slightly manic, tide lifting all boats.
Exactly. Whereas now, it's a geyser erupting under a handful of specific boats, the AI boats, and lifting them into the stratosphere, while everyone else is still stuck in low tide. We're talking about OpenAI, Anthropic, Cohere, maybe a few other foundational model players, and some massive AI infrastructure companies. That's where the capital is going.
Okay, so let's play devil's advocate for a second. Is this irrational, or is it the only logical response to the current technological moment? To build a state-of-the-art large language model, the cost of compute is, we're talking billions in GPUs from NVIDIA, massive data centers, and an army of the most expensive PhDs on the planet. This isn't two people building a SaaS app in a garage. The capital requirements are fundamentally different.
Oh, absolutely. The capital intensity is undeniable. You can't bootstrap your way to a GPT-5 competitor. So from that perspective, the mega rounds make sense. But it introduces a level of systemic risk we've never seen before in venture. The article highlights that OpenAI's $40 billion financing earlier this year accounted for roughly a quarter of all U.S. mega round funding.
A quarter of the top end of the market in one deal. Wow.
It's a portfolio concentration that would give any traditional asset manager a heart attack. And it's not just one fund doing this. It's the same pool of large interconnected investors piling into the same few companies. The Q3 report lists the most active investors: Insight Partners, General Catalyst, Excel, Andreessen Horowitz, Iconic. It's a who's who of venture, and they're all placing massive overlapping bets on the same outlook.
It screams FOMO. It has that same energy from 2021, the fear of missing out. The feeling that if you're a multi-billion dollar fund and you don't have a significant stake in Anthropic or OpenAI, your LPs are going to be asking some very tough questions in a few years. There's a career risk in not making the bet, which pushes valuations and round sizes even higher. You're not just betting on the technology, you're betting on being in the club.
And that brings us to the big, flashing, billion-dollar question that the second Crunchbase article tackles head-on. Are we in a bubble? It's tempting to look at these numbers and scream yes, but the article does a great job of laying out how today is different from 2021.
Right. The first big difference is the one we've been talking about: concentration. In 2021, the boom was everywhere. If that market corrected, everything corrected. But the argument now is that if the AI market sees a correction, it might be more contained. The sectors that haven't seen a boom can't, by definition, see a post-boom crash. Though, as the author Riley notes, further declines are always possible.
A comforting thought, but I think there's a more fundamental difference. In many ways, the product is already here. Businesses are actively integrating these AI models into their workflows today. It's not a hypothetical future like the metaverse was a few years ago. Companies are seeing real productivity gains, launching new AI-powered features, and customers are paying for them.
I agree completely. This isn't Webvan promising grocery delivery in 30 minutes back in 1999, a vision that was miles ahead of the actual logistics and consumer behavior. This is different. A law firm can use an AI tool from a company like Harvey, which is built on OpenAI's tech, to cut their document review time in half, starting tomorrow. That's tangible, immediate value. The adoption curve for this technology is the fastest we've ever seen, which helps to justify some of the investment enthusiasm.
It does, but let's not get too carried away. The valuations are still pricing in decades of flawless execution and market dominance. And this leads to another key difference from 2021. The exit environment is completely different. The IPO market is not on fire.
Not even close. The article points this out perfectly. In 2021, we had hundreds of venture-backed companies going public via IPOs, SPACs, direct listings. It was a frenzy. This year, less than 50. We've had a few big ones like CoreWeave and Figma, and the Klarna IPO certainly helps sentiment in Europe, but it's a trickle, not a flood.
And crucially, the biggest AI unicorns, OpenAI and Anthropic, are showing zero signs of wanting to go public. They're raising effectively public market-sized rounds from private investors. This keeps their valuation somewhat theoretical. They don't have to deal with the daily scrutiny of the public markets, the quarterly earnings calls, the analyst downgrades. Any drop in valuation, if it happens, can play out slowly and quietly behind closed doors.
That's a double-edged sword, though. It protects them from market volatility, but it also means there's less transparency and no real liquidity event for these early investors and employees. The whole ecosystem is built on the promise of an eventual exit. And right now, for the biggest players, that exit path is what? A multi-hundred billion dollar acquisition by Microsoft or Google? That seems unlikely to pass regulatory muster.
It's a huge unresolved question, and it ties back to that systemic risk I mentioned. The interconnectedness of these deals is what worries me most. You have Microsoft deeply embedded with OpenAI. You have Google, Amazon, and Salesforce all pouring billions into Anthropic. These tech giants are both customers, partners, and investors. The venture funds are investing in the AI labs, and then those same funds are investing in application layer companies that are customers of those AI labs.
It's a circular economy.
It's a very tightly wound circular economy. And if one of the core foundational model companies stumbles, if there's a technical plateau, a security disaster, or a major regulatory crackdown, the shockwaves won't just hit that one company. It will ripple through their strategic backers, their venture investors, and the entire ecosystem of startups built on their APIs.
The concentration creates a single point of failure for a huge chunk of the venture market.
That's the bear case, and it's a strong one. But let's wrap this part of the discussion with the bull case. The opportunity here is that this isn't just another tech trend. This is potentially a new technological platform on the scale of the internet or the mobile phone. It's a fundamental shift in how we interact with information and create economic value.
The platform shift argument. Exactly. And in a platform shift, the winners become generational companies. Think of Google for search or Apple for mobile. The venture bet is that one or two of these AI labs will achieve that level of dominance. From that perspective, a $100 billion valuation might even look cheap in a decade. The risk is astronomical, yes, but the potential reward is so massive that for these funds, it's a risk they feel they have to take. It's the ultimate venture bet, just supersized for 2025.
A high-stakes poker game with the future of technology as the pot. So while that game is happening at the main table with champagne and billion-dollar chips, there's a whole other story unfolding in the rest of the room. A much quieter and, for many founders, a much more painful story. Let's talk about the have-nots.
Yes, the flip side of this AI gold rush is the silent crisis happening almost everywhere else. And for me, George, the most alarming chart in this whole report is the one on seed deals.
I agree. It's not the sexiest headline, but it might be the most important for the long-term health of the ecosystem. The report shows that the number of seed deals has been on a steady downward trend for several quarters.
Right. And this is key. The total dollars invested at the seed stage has stayed relatively steady. So what does that mean? It means the average seed deal is getting larger, but they are also much, much harder to come by. Fewer companies are getting that first critical check.
The funnel is narrowing right at the very beginning. We're making fewer bets. It's the same concentration thing we saw with mega rounds, but now it's trickling all the way down to the earliest stage. VCs are writing bigger checks to fewer obvious seed stage winners, probably the ones with a strong AI angle or a team that comes from OpenAI or Google Brain.
And this raises a fundamental question. Is innovation actually slowing down? Are there just fewer good ideas out there? Or is investor attention so completely captured by AI that they've lost the appetite for anything else? I strongly suspect it's the latter. We're creating these blind spots.
Let's put a name to some of those blind spots. The report is blunt. Biotech, for instance. Biotech's share of U.S. venture funding recently hit a 20-year low.
That one just hurts, a 20-year low. We are living through a revolution in biological sciences with technologies like CRISPR and mRNA, and yet investment is retreating. This is a sector that cures diseases, extends human life, and tackles our most fundamental health challenges. And it's being starved of capital because all the oxygen in the room is being inhaled by LLMs.
And the great irony, which you and I have talked about before, is that AI is one of the most powerful tools ever handed to the biotech industry.
AI-powered drug discovery, protein folding prediction with things like AlphaFold, these are revolutionary applications. But it seems investors aren't interested in funding a biotech company using AI. They want to fund an AI company applied to biotech. The branding, the framing has become everything.
It's all about the label on the tin. And it's not just biotech. The report points out that clean tech investment is on track for a multi-year low as well. Another sector critical to our future. Another area where AI can be a massive accelerant for things like grid management, battery chemistry, and material science. And it's also getting the cold shoulder.
The one that really surprised me was cybersecurity. Investment there has also retreated. In an era where the threat landscape is exploding, in part because bad actors are also using AI to create more sophisticated attacks, you would think this would be a bull market for cybersecurity startups.
It's a head-scratcher. My best guess, and this is just a theory, is a combination of two things. First, market fatigue. Cybersecurity is a very crowded space, and it can be hard for a new startup to differentiate itself. Second, and maybe more importantly, is the platform effect. Microsoft is baking so much security into Azure and Office 365 with its Copilot for Security. Google is doing the same with its cloud platform.
So the thinking is, why fund a standalone point solution when the massive AI supercharged platforms are just going to bundle it in as a feature?
Exactly. It's a legitimate threat for startups in that space. Unless you have something truly defensible and 10x better, it's a tough sell when investors are looking for potential monopolies, not just nice features.
So we have biotech, clean tech, and cybersecurity all in the have-not camp. But the report does highlight a couple of sectors that have managed to break through, specifically because they are such clear and immediate beneficiaries of AI.
Yes, the silver lining. Legal tech is the prime example. It hit an all-time high for funding last month, and it makes perfect sense. The legal profession is built on a mountain of text-based data, contracts, and precedents. It's an industry ripe for disruption by large language models that can read, summarize, and analyze that information in seconds.
It's the drudgery automation play. AI is coming for the boring, repetitive parts of the job, like reviewing a 1,000-page disclosure document. That frees up lawyers to focus on higher-level strategy. It's a clear, demonstrable ROI, and investors are flocking to it.
And we're seeing the same thing in another sector mentioned in the report, HR tech. AI-powered recruitment tools that can sift through thousands of resumes, AI chatbots for employee onboarding, AI-driven performance management. Again, it's about automating administrative overhead and making processes more efficient.
So the lesson here isn't that investors hate everything that isn't a foundational model. It's that for application layer companies, they need to see a direct, almost comically obvious path to value creation using AI. The long, capital-intensive, high-risk R&D cycles of deep tech, like in biotech or clean tech, are just out of fashion right now.
They want a simple story. We take X process, apply Y AI model, and achieve Z efficiency gain. It's a much easier investment thesis to underwrite than we're going to spend 10 years and $200 million trying to cure Alzheimer's, and it might not work.
Which, when you say it out loud, is a pretty sobering reflection on the current state of venture capital. It exposes the tension between seeking world-changing breakthroughs and seeking predictable, scalable returns. Right now, the latter is winning.
So let's summarize the risks and opportunities here in this world of have-nots. The risk, to me, is profound. We're creating an innovation monoculture. By channeling so much capital and talent into one specific area of technology, we risk missing out on the next big breakthroughs in health, climate, and other critical fields. We could be inadvertently starving the next Genentech or the next Tesla before it even gets its seed round.
That's the big picture danger. The entire forest becomes one type of tree, making it incredibly vulnerable to a single disease. But what's the opportunity in this lopsided market?
The opportunity is for the contrarian, for the specialist investor who isn't chasing the hot trend. If everyone is zigging towards AI mega rounds, there have to be phenomenal under-the-radar companies zagging in biotech or advanced manufacturing or robotics.
their valuations will be more reasonable. There will be less competition to get into the deals. The founders will be gritty and mission-driven because they have to be.
It's a classic market inefficiency. If you have deep domain expertise in one of these forgotten sectors and you have patient capital, this could be a golden era for you. You can build a portfolio of incredible companies at same prices while everyone else is fighting to get a tiny slice of Anthropic at a $100 billion valuation.
It's a bet on diversification, a bet that the future will be built on more than large language models. And I think that's a pretty good bet to make.
A tale of two markets, really. An AI gold rush on one side, fueled by FOMO and unprecedented sums of capital, creating a handful of giants. And on the other side, a quiet struggle for almost everyone else, but with hidden pockets of incredible opportunity for those willing to look. On that note, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll zoom in from the macro view to the micro, with deep dives into two companies that are navigating this market in very different ways. One in the quiet world of dental SaaS, and the other in the explosive arena of live commerce. Stay with us. All right, we're back on Startup Jazz. Before the break, we were talking about the lopsided venture market. Now we're going to look at two companies that represent very different ways to thrive in this environment. We're shifting gears dramatically, moving from the high-stakes, high-tech world of AI into a space that is, well, let's just say it's a lot closer to home for most of us. In fact, it's right in our mouths.
In our mouths, George? That's one way to put it. We're talking about the dentist's office. And I know, for a lot of people, that's not exactly a place they associate with cutting-edge technology and smooth, delightful user experiences.
Exactly. It's more often associated with the sound of a drill and the smell of whatever that smell is. But that's precisely the opportunity. We're talking about a company called Archy, spelled A-R-C-H-Y. And their story is a classic, almost textbook example of a perfect vertical SaaS startup.
It really is. The headline from Crunchbase News says it all. Exclusive, founded by Uber alumni, Archy raises $20 million to put dental practices on autopilot. The founder's story here is fantastic. It starts with Jonathan Ratt, who was a product manager at places we've all heard of, Uber, Meta, SurveyMonkey. In 2021, he was watching his wife, who is a dentist, just constantly struggling with the technology stack at her own practice.
This is the spouse problem, and it's one of my favorite founder archetypes. It's not some abstract market analysis in a deck. It's a real, tangible, daily frustration that you see a loved one going through. The motivation to solve that problem is incredibly powerful. So Rat starts digging in, and what he finds is kind of shocking, but also not surprising at all if you've ever been in a small medical office.
Right. He discovered that most of the software being used in the dental industry was over 20 years. 20 years. Think about the technology you were using 20 years ago. We were barely on broadband, the first iPhone was still years away, and MySpace was the cool new thing. That's the tech foundation these modern medical practices are built on.
It's insane. The article quotes him saying the software lacked integrations, it was slow, buggy, and impossible to train new employees on. And a lot of it still required physical servers on site. You know, the beige box humming away in a closet somewhere that the one IT guy who comes in once a month is allowed to touch.
The dreaded server closet. So seeing this mess, Rat teams up with another Uber alum, Benjamin Collin, who was a director of engineering there. And this is a key detail. The two of them previously led the team that rebuilt Uber's payment platform, a system that is still in use today. So these aren't just a couple of guys with an idea. They have serious experience building complex, scalable, mission-critical software.
That's the Uber Mafia effect right there. That credential carries so much weight with investors and early customers. They know how to build things that don't fall over at scale. So they started Archy with this mission to build a modern, cloud-based platform to, as they say, put dental practices on autopilot.
And investors are clearly biting. Archy just raised a $20 million Series B round. The round was led by TCV, a major growth equity firm, with participation from big names like Bessemer Venture Partners and CRV.
This brings their total funding to $47 million.
And here's a detail I absolutely love. The round also included participation from 25 practicing dentists who wrote checks as angel investors. To me, that is the ultimate validation. It's not just VCs seeing a market opportunity. It's the actual target customers, the end users, saying, yes, this is what we need. Take my money and build it faster.
That's a signal you just can't fake. So what does Arkey actually do? The promise is that it's an all-in-one tool. It claims to replace more than 5 existing separate tools that a dental practice would normally have to cobble together. We're talking scheduling, patient charting, billing, medical imaging like x-rays, insurance claims, payments, staff management, patient messaging, reporting, all of it from one single login.
The single pane of glass. It's the holy grail for any small business owner. The cognitive load of switching between 5 different apps with 5 different logins and 5 different user interfaces, none of which talk to each other, is a massive hidden cost of doing business. Arkey is eliminating that.
And they're not just stopping at being a modern integrated system. They're building AI agents on top of it. This is where the autopilot claim really comes to life. The AI is designed to handle the tedious, repetitive, busy work that consumes so much of the staff's time. Things like checking a patient's insurance eligibility before their appointment, automatically filing claims after the appointment, following up on unpaid claims, writing up clinical notes, managing patient communication, and scheduling.
That's huge. Every one of those tasks is a time sink. I mean, think about the person at the front desk whose entire job is basically being on the phone with insurance companies, chasing down payments. If you can automate 80% of that, you've just fundamentally changed the economics of that practice. You freed up that person to focus on patient experience, on growing the business, instead of being a professional paper pusher.
The results they're reporting are pretty staggering. The article says Arkey is already processing over $100 million in payments annually across 45 states. They've seen roughly 300% year-over-year growth. They serve 2.5 million patients and have processed over 35 million x-rays through the platform.
And here's the money quote for any potential customer. They claim that mid-sized dental practices report saving around 80 hours a month by using their tech. 80 hours? That is 2 full work weeks. For a small business, that is game-changing. It's the difference between being profitable and not, between the owner getting to go home at 5 p.m. or staying until 9 p.m. to do paperwork.
The results they're reporting are pretty staggering. The article says Arkey is already processing over $100 million in payments annually across 45 states. They've seen roughly 300% year-over-year growth. They serve 2.5 million patients and have processed over 35 million x-rays through the platform.
And here's the money quote for any potential customer. They claim that mid-sized dental practices report saving around 80 hours a month by using their tech. 80 hours? That is 2 full work weeks. For a small business, that is game-changing. It's the difference between being profitable and not, between the owner getting to go home at 5 p.m. or staying until 9 p.m. to do paperwork.
And it's not just time savings. They mentioned one practice saved about $50,000 in its first year just by avoiding the big upfront hardware costs of those old on-premise server systems. So the ROI is incredibly clear.
Let's talk about the business model for a second, because I think it's really smart. They have a dual revenue model. First, there's a standard subscription fee with different tiers. That gives them predictable recurring revenue. But second, they also act as the merchant processor for their clients, taking a small percentage of the payment transactions that flow through the platform.
I love that model. It's becoming more and more common in vertical SaaS. It aligns Arkey's success directly with their customer's success. The more patients the dental practice sees, the more payments they process, the more revenue Arkey generates. It turns them from just a software vendor into a true business partner.
It's a beautiful thing. So, they've got a great founder story, a massive and underserved market, a proven team, clear product market fit, and a smart business model. But what are the challenges here? It can't be all smooth sailing. The big incumbents in this space are companies like Henry Schein, which makes the Dentrix software, and Patterson Dental with their EagleSoft system.
These are massive, publicly traded companies that have owned this market for decades.
That's the biggest hurdle, without a doubt. It's the classic innovator's dilemma. The incumbents are entrenched. And for a dental practice, their practice management software, or PMS, is the absolute core of their operation. Ripping it out and replacing it is the equivalent of open-heart surgery for the business. The switching costs are enormous.
You have to migrate decades of patient data, x-rays, billing records, and all of it is sensitive, HIPAA-protected data, so you can't afford any mistakes. Then you have to retrain your entire staff, the dentists, the hygienists, the front desk, on a brand new system. It's a massive undertaking.
This is why the user experience is so critical. It can't just be a little bit better. It has to be 10 times better to justify that pain of switching. And that seems to be Archie's key weapon. The lead investor from TCV, Austin Levitt, had a great quote in the article. He said his firm had been looking at the dental space for a long time, but no one was really tackling the core PMS problem correctly.
And he said, "We consistently heard that Archie was supremely easy to use, requiring almost no training in contrast to others, providing a seamless iPhone-like experience, and reducing what took 10 clicks in other software to one or none in Archie."
iPhone-like experience. That's the magic phrase. If you can make your software so intuitive that it requires almost no training, you have dramatically lowered the friction of adoption and neutralized a huge part of that switching cost. If a new hire can be productive on day one without a week-long training seminar, that's a massive win.
It really is. So the risks are clear. High switching costs, a long sales cycle to convince these practices to make the jump, and the ever-present risk of data security and HIPAA compliance, where one mistake could be fatal for the company. But the opportunity is just vast. The article pegs the dental industry at $500 billion. These practices have been starved of good technology for decades.
And once you own that core system of record for a dental practice, you can expand from there. You can layer on more services, supply chain management, marketing tools, payroll, you name it. And the playbook is repeatable. Once you've conquered dentistry, you can move into orthodontics, optometry, veterinary clinics, any specialized small medical practice that runs on 20-year-old software.
Absolutely. My take is that this is a brilliant execution of a proven playbook. Find a technologically neglected, high-value industry, build a product that users genuinely love, and wrap it in a modern, aligned business model. Archie is one to watch. It's not flashy, but it's the kind of business that can quietly become a multi-billion-dollar giant.
I completely agree. A fantastic example of solving a real, painful problem with elegant technology.
Okay, from the quiet, methodical world of dental SaaS, we're about to do a complete 180. We're going from a company saving dentists time to a company that has created a whole new way for people to spend their time and their money, a lot of money. Michelle, get ready for the hype train. We're talking about whatnot.
The hype train is right. I mean, the numbers in this next story are just mind-boggling. This is another Crunchbase News exclusive with the title, Whatnot Lands $225 million Series F, more than doubles valuation to $11.5 billion since January.
Let's just pause and absorb that for a second. A $225 million Series F round. That's a massive fundraise in any market, but especially in the current, more constrained venture environment. And the valuation, $11.5 billion. For perspective, the article notes they raised a Series E in January at a nearly $5 billion valuation, so they more than doubled their valuation in less than 10 months.
That is just blistering speed. It's the kind of valuation growth we saw in the peak froth of 2021, not what we expect to see today. It immediately tells you that whatever Whatnot is doing, their internal growth metrics must be absolutely astronomical to command that kind of investor confidence.
For listeners who might not be familiar, Whatnot is a live shopping platform and marketplace. Think of it as a chaotic, high-energy fusion of QVC, Twitch, and eBay.
Sellers, who are often charismatic creators and subject matter experts, go live on video, showcasing products and auctioning them off in real time to a live audience who are all chatting, bidding, and reacting.
It started out focused on collectibles, things like Pokemon cards, sports cards, Funko Pops, vintage toys. It was a perfect entry point because those are categories where community, authenticity, and the condition of the item are paramount. A live video stream is a much better way to sell a rare Charizard card than a few static photos on an eBay listing. You can show it off, turn it around, answer questions, and create a real sense of event and urgency around the sale.
That's the key. It's not just a transaction, it's entertainment, it's shoppertainment. People don't just go on Whatnot to buy a specific thing. They go to hang out, to watch their favorite sellers, to be part of a community, and to get that dopamine hit from the thrill of a live auction. It's a fundamentally different user behavior than the search and buy model of Amazon or eBay.
And it has clearly struck a chord. The investor list for this Series F is a who's who of venture capital. The round was co-led by DST Global and Capital G, which is Alphabet's independent growth fund. You've got new money from Sequoia and returning backers like Andreessen Horowitz, Greycroft, and Bond. When you see a cap table like that, you know you're looking at one of the breakout companies of this era. Their total funding is now just shy of $1 billion, at $968 million.
The traction numbers in the article explain the valuation. Whatnot says that more than $6 billion worth of items have been sold on its platform so far this year. And get this, that's more than double its total for all of 2024. The growth is not just linear, it's accelerating at an incredible pace.
That's insane. Gross merchandise value, or GMV, doubling in less than a year at that kind of scale is almost unheard of. It points to a powerful network effect taking hold. More buyers bring more sellers, who bring more unique inventory, which in turn attracts even more buyers. It's the classic marketplace flywheel, but supercharged by the engagement of live video.
Live commerce has been this mythical beast for years in the West. It's absolutely enormous in China, with platforms like Taobao Live driving hundreds of billions in sales. But everyone who tried to bring it to the U.S. struggled. Amazon, Facebook, Instagram, they all launched live shopping features that kind of fizzled out. The big question was always, is this a cultural phenomenon that just doesn't translate?
And Whatnot seems to be the one that finally cracked the code. I think their strategy of starting with niche, high-passion communities was brilliant. They didn't try to be everything to everyone from day one. They went deep on collectibles, built an authentic community, and proved the model there. Now they're expanding into other categories like clothing, sneakers, and more. They built the cultural beachhead first.
I think that's exactly right. The other key is that they built their entire platform around the live experience. For Facebook or eBay, live shopping feels like a feature that was bolted on to an existing platform. For Whatnot, it is the platform. The entire user experience, the discovery algorithms, the tools for sellers, it's all optimized for that live interactive format.
So what are the threats here? When you're growing this fast and have this much attention on you, the giants start to wake up. And the biggest, scariest giant in this space has to be TikTok with TikTok Shop.
Oh, absolutely. TikTok is the 800-pound gorilla. They have 1 billion users, an algorithm that is terrifyingly good at knowing what you want to see, and they are pushing hard into e-commerce. The competition is going to be fierce. It's a battle of two different approaches.
Exactly. Whatnot is a dedicated shopping destination. Users go there with the intent to browse and buy. It's a high-intent environment. TikTok is a general entertainment platform, a fire hose of content, where shopping is an integrated feature. They can drive a massive amount of traffic, but the user's intent might be lower. They're there to be entertained, and maybe they'll buy something they see.
It's the mall versus the town square argument. Whatnot is the specialized mall where you go to shop. TikTok is the town square where everything is happening, including some commerce on the side. It's not clear yet which model will win or if there's room for both. Whatnot's challenge is to keep its community feel and its focus on being the best place for sellers as it scales, to prevent them from being lured away by TikTok's massive audience.
And that leads to another major risk, trust and safety.
Any marketplace at this scale becomes a target for fraud, counterfeit goods, and all sorts of bad behavior. In a live, fast-paced auction environment, it's even harder to police. The article mentions they plan to use the new funds to evolve their policies, which is a clear nod to this challenge. They have to invest millions upon millions in moderation, both human and automated, to keep the platform safe, or trust will erode and the flywheel will grind to a halt.
Another risk is creator burnout. The platform runs on the energy of its sellers. These people are on for hours, performing, entertaining, managing bids, packing orders. It can be incredibly draining. Whatnot needs to build a world-class suite of tools to make life easier for their sellers. Better analytics, logistics support, financing. They need to become the Shopify for live sellers, not just the marketplace.
That's a great point. The seller is their most important customer. Another interesting detail from the funding announcement was the mention of a tender offer, where select investors will buy up to $126 million worth of shares. This is essentially a way to create liquidity for early employees and investors without going public. It's a sign of a mature, late-stage company rewarding its early believers, but it also signals that an IPO might not be on the immediate horizon. They're capitalizing on the private markets to stay private longer.
It's a smart move. It keeps the team focused on growth without the quarterly pressures of the public markets. Looking ahead, the opportunity is still immense. They're accelerating international expansion, which is a huge dream field. And they can continue to expand into new product categories. Anything that benefits from a live demonstration or has a strong community around it is fair game. Art, luxury watches, wine, even cars someday.
Whatnot's success is proof that retail's new normal, as their CEO claims, is going to be a lot more interactive, community-driven, and entertaining than just clicking add to cart on a static web page. They've captured lightning in a bottle, and now the challenge is to build the infrastructure to contain that energy and turn it into a durable, long-lasting business. An $11.5 billion valuation says the smartest money in the world is betting they can do it.
It's a wild ride, and a fascinating contrast to the deliberate, methodical approach of a vertical SaaS company like Archie. Two very different paths to building a massive company. That's all the time we have for this segment. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be diving into our final company of the day, a startup that's trying to reinvent one of the most frustrating parts of modern business. Stick with us. And we are back for the fourth and final segment of Startup Jazz, Episode 3. We've saved a big one for last, a story that has everything. A massive pivot, a boatload of venture capital, big name investors, a rebrand, and a long-awaited IPO that, well, let's just say it didn't quite get the standing ovation the team was hoping for.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it, Michelle. We are talking about Navan, formerly known as Trip Actions. The headline from Crunchbase News tells a big part of the story. Shares of Navan closed down 20% in long-awaited IPO debut. Ouch.
Ouch is right. After years of being a private market darling, that is a tough first day on the public stage. But there is so much more to this company than one day of trading. So let's rewind the clock a bit and talk about what Navan actually is and where they came from.
Absolutely. So at its core, Navan is a software platform for businesses to manage all things travel and expense. Think of it as an all-in-one command center. You can book flights, hotels, rental cars, and then you can manage the expenses that come with it, often through their own corporate card solution. The goal is to take a process that is famously fragmented and painful, booking on one site, filing expenses on another, waiting for reimbursements, and unify it into a single slick experience.
And the original name, Trip Actions, really spoke to that initial focus. It was all about the trip. The company was founded back in 2015 by two serial entrepreneurs, Ariel Cohen and Elon Twig. And this isn't their first rodeo together, which I always think is a fascinating dynamic. They had a previous company, Stream, once that they sold to Jive Software. So they clearly have a strong working relationship and a history of building and exiting. They saw this massive, sleepy, legacy-dominated market of corporate travel and thought, we can do better.
And for a while, they were on an absolute tear. They were the classic Silicon Valley rocket ship. The product was great, companies were signing up, and they were raising money at a furious pace. They brought in the biggest names in venture capital. We're talking Andreessen Horowitz, Lightspeed Venture Partners, Z Ventures. The war chest was massive. The article notes they raised $1 billion in equity funding and another $1.2 billion in debt financing. That's over $2 billion in capital before even hitting the public markets.
It's an incredible amount of fuel, and they were using it to scale aggressively. But then 2020 happened. The COVID-19 pandemic hits and the world shuts down. And if your entire company is built on the premise of people traveling for business, what happens when all business travel evaporates overnight?
Your revenue goes to zero. Literally, zero. I cannot imagine the sheer terror of being a founder or an employee at that company in March of 2020. You have this multi-billion dollar valuation, hundreds of employees, investors who have poured in $1 billion, and your core business activity has just ceased to exist on a global scale.
It's a true stare into the abyss moment. And this, for me, is the most compelling part of their story. This is where they had to make a choice. Do they hibernate, lay everyone off, and hope the world comes back to normal? Or do they pivot? They chose to pivot. And to pivot hard.
They did. They realized that even if people weren't traveling, companies still had expenses. People were buying home office equipment, software subscriptions, virtual team lunch deliveries. The spend part of the business was still there. So they accelerated their roadmap on the broader expense management platform. This is when the shift from Trip Actions, a travel company, to Navan, an all-in-one travel and expense platform, really began in earnest. The rebrand came later, but the strategic shift was born out of that crisis.
It was a brilliant move, born of necessity. They already had the customers. They had the relationships with the CFOs and finance teams. They just needed to offer them more. They leaned into their corporate card product, Liquid, and built out the software to manage all non-travel-related spend. In doing so, they dramatically expanded their total addressable market, or TAM. They went from being a player in the corporate travel market to a player in the much, much larger corporate spend management market.
Which puts them in a whole new weight class, but also a whole new competitive arena, which we'll get to. But first, let's talk about this IPO. The article says it was long-awaited, and that's no exaggeration. They reportedly filed confidentially to go public more than 3 years ago, so they've been in the waiting room for a while, watching the markets, waiting for the right window.
And in 2025, the window seemed to be cracking open. We saw Klarna have a good debut, Figure did well. There was a sense that the IPO market was thawing. So Navan decides it's time to pull the trigger. They price their shares at $25 a pop.
And this is where it gets really interesting from a numbers perspective. The IPO raised a very respectable $923 million for the company. At $25 per share, it gave them an initial valuation of around $6.2 billion. Now, $6.2 billion is an enormous number for any company. But in the world of venture capital, context is everything. And the crucial piece of context here is their last private valuation.
Right. When they raised money before the IPO, what were investors saying the company was worth? And from what I've seen, their last big private round in late 2022 valued them at $9.2 billion.
Exactly. So they went public at $6.2 billion. That's a $3 billion haircut. This is what's known as a down round IPO. For the founders, early employees, and early investors, it's still a phenomenal outcome. But for the investors who came in on that last round, they are instantly underwater. They paid a price that implied a $9.2 billion valuation, and the public market is now saying it's only worth $6.2 billion.
And then it gets worse. The stock opens for trading, and by the end of the day, it closes at $20 a share, down 20% from the IPO price. So that $6.2 billion valuation is now suddenly closer to $5 billion. It's a brutal welcome to the public markets.
It's a stark reminder that the public markets and the private venture markets are two different beasts with very different appetites. Private investors, especially during the 2021-2022 boom, were paying for growth at any cost. They were underwriting a story of future domination. Public market investors in 2025, they want to see that growth, yes, but they also want to see a clear, believable path to profitability. And that's the rub for Navin.
Let's talk about those numbers, because the S-1 filing lays it all out. Revenue is growing, which is good. The article says they pulled in $329 million in the first half of 2025, which is up 30% year over year. That's solid growth for a company of their size. It shows that the travel market is recovering and their pivot to broader expense management is paying off.
But, and it's a big but, they are burning a mountain of cash to get that growth. Their net loss for that same period was just under $100 million. And what's more concerning is that the loss grew by about 7% compared to the year before. So they're not growing into profitability. At the moment, they're just growing their losses.
And the filing itself is brutally honest about this. There's a line that's pretty standard in these things, but it always jumps out to me. It says, Navin has incurred net losses in each year since its inception in 2015 and may not achieve or, if achieved, sustain profitability in the future. That's the kind of language that makes a public market investor who isn't a VC very, very nervous.
It's the fundamental tension of these crossover tech companies. The story they're selling to investors is one of massive future potential driven by technology. And to their credit, Navin has a sexy story to tell there. The article mentions their big push into AI with something called Navin Cognition.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up. This seems to be their key narrative for the future. They're pitching this idea of an agentic AI that can automate all the annoying parts of travel and expense. So instead of you having to search for flights that fit your schedule and your company's budget policy, you could just tell the AI, book me a trip to the New York office for our Q4 planning meeting next month, get me a hotel near Times Square, and keep the whole thing under $1,500. And the AI just does it.
And on the expense side, maybe it sees a calendar invite for a client dinner at a certain restaurant, sees the charge come through on your Navin corporate card, and automatically creates the expense report, categorizes it, and submits it for approval without you ever lifting a finger.
That is the dream, right? That's the holy grail of business software, making an annoying, time-consuming process completely disappear. If they can actually pull that off, if Navin Cognition is as good as they say it is, that could be a true game changer and a powerful moat. But agentic AI is also one of the buzziest, frothiest terms in tech right now. Every company is an AI company. The question for investors is this real, defensible technology, or is it just a fancy wrapper around a large language model API?
And that brings us to the competitive landscape, which is just a minefield. On one side, you have the 800-pound gorilla, SAP Concur. It's old, it's clunky, nobody loves using it, but it is deeply, deeply entrenched in the Fortune 500. Ripping out Concur is a massive undertaking that most large companies are not willing to go through. It's the classic, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM argument.
Then on the other side, you have the new school of spend management, the fintech-first companies like Brex and Ramp. They started with the corporate card and a slick software experience for startups and are now aggressively moving up market. They are incredibly well-funded, savvy marketers, and they are attacking the expense part of Navin's business with a vengeance.
So Navin is fighting a two-front war. They're trying to convince large enterprises to ditch their legacy provider, Concur, while simultaneously trying to fend off the faster, more nimble startups like Brex and Ramp, who are eating their lunch in the startup and mid-market segment. It is an incredibly tough position to be in. They're squeezed in the middle.
So what do you see as their biggest opportunities coming out of this IPO? They've got the cash, they've got the brand recognition. Where do they go from here?
The biggest opportunity, I think, is to deliver on that all-in-one platform promise in a way that no one else has. Concur has travel and expense, but it's not a modern integrated experience. Brex and Ramp have amazing spend management, but travel is more of a bolt-on for them, often through partnerships.
if Navan can be the one company that truly nails the seamless integration of travel booking, corporate cards, and expense management, powered by that slick AI they're promising, that's a winning proposition.
I agree. The pain point is real. I've lived it. Juggling a booking in one app, a credit card in another, and an expense platform from the Stone Age. A single pane of glass for all of it is incredibly appealing. I also think there's a huge opportunity for them in international expansion. Business travel is a global phenomenon, and managing multi-currency expenses and different regional travel policies is a nightmare. A platform that can unify that globally is immensely valuable.
And with nearly $1 billion in fresh IPO cash, they have the capital to invest heavily in R&D to build out that AI and to fund that international go-to-market strategy. They could even get acquisitive and buy smaller regional players or point solutions to accelerate their roadmap. The IPO, despite the poor day one performance, still gives them a powerful currency and a lot of strategic options.
Okay, so that's the bull case. Let's flip it. What are the biggest risks? What could cause this whole thing to stumble? The profitability question seems like the most obvious one.
It's number one with a bullet. The public markets are just not as patient as venture capitalists. The clock is now ticking, very publicly. Every quarter, they will have to report their earnings. And every quarter, analysts will be asking, when are you going to stop losing so much money? The pressure to cut spending on sales and marketing or R&D, the very things they need to fuel growth and innovation, is going to be immense.
And if they can't show a clear path to profitability, the stock could just languish. And that creates a vicious cycle. A low stock price makes it harder to use your stock for acquisitions, and it really hurts employee morale. So many Navan employees have stock options that are now likely underwater, priced at that higher $9.2 billion valuation. It becomes a huge retention problem. Your best engineers and salespeople start looking at the exit door.
The second major risk is simply the sheer intensity of the competition we just talked about. Can they really build a better tech moat than Ramp and Brex, who are known for their incredible engineering velocity? And can they build a strong enough enterprise sales motion to unseat an incumbent like Concur? Doing either one is hard. Doing both at the same time is a monumental challenge.
There's also a macroeconomic risk, isn't there? Their fortunes are still heavily tied to the health of the global economy. When a recession hits, what are the first two things that companies cut from their budgets? Marketing spend and T&E, travel and entertainment. Their revenue is inherently cyclical. They saw the most extreme version of this during the pandemic, but even a garden variety economic downturn could significantly impact their growth and make that path to profitability even longer and harder.
It's so true. So you look at the whole picture, an incredible story of resilience and a massive pivot, a huge amount of capital raised from the best investors, a big, important problem to solve, but also a broken IPO with a valuation cut, staggering losses with no end in sight, and a brutal competitive landscape. It's a classic high-risk, high-reward situation.
It really is. I'm rooting for them, honestly. The founders have been through the ringer and have shown incredible grit. And as a user, I desperately want the product they are promising to exist. A truly intelligent, automated travel and expense platform would make life so much better for millions of business travelers. But wanting them to succeed and believing they can overcome these massive hurdles are two different things. This will be a fascinating one to watch over the next few years. Will they be able to grow into their valuation and turn the ship towards profitability? Or will they be crushed between the legacy giants and the nimble upstarts?
The public markets have placed their initial bet, and it wasn't a confident one. Now it's up to Ariel, Ilan, and the entire Navan team to prove them wrong. It's a tough spot to be in, but it's also the kind of challenge that great companies are forged from. A truly fascinating story to cap off our episode.
All right, what a journey this episode has been. As we bring episode 3 to a close, Michelle, it's worth taking a moment to connect the dots. We covered a ton of ground.
We really did. We started with the deeply personal, Sasha Orloff's story of redefining his identity after being a founder CEO. It's a reminder that there's a human at the center of all this.
Then we went to the structural, with regulation as alpha, showing how building a durable legal foundation is no longer an afterthought, but a core competitive advantage.
It's about building things to last.
From there, we looked at the entire market context, this tale of two cities, where AI is attracting unprecedented capital while other critical sectors are being starved. That context shapes every decision a founder makes.
Against that backdrop, we saw three very different playbooks. Archie, with its quiet, methodical, vertical SaaS approach, solving a real unglamorous problem for dentists.
Then Whatnot, the complete opposite, a hyper-growth, community-fueled rocket ship that's creating an entirely new category in live commerce. It's all about capturing lightning in a bottle.
And we ended with Navin, the late-stage giant that had to survive a near-death experience, execute a massive pivot, and is now navigating the harsh, unforgiving realities of the public markets.
The through line for me is adaptation and resilience. The startup journey is never a straight line. It's about having the self-awareness to step away, like Sasha, the foresight to build a moat, like the regulation as alpha companies, or the sheer grit to pivot your entire business, like Navin did.
Well said. It's about intentionality. Whether it's your career, your compliance, or your company strategy, the old model of just winging it is over. The companies and founders that succeed are the ones who build thoughtfully for the long haul.
A perfect summary. And on that note, that's a wrap for episode 3 of Startup Jazz. A huge thank you to all of you for tuning in and spending part of your day with us. We love digging into these stories, and we hope you get as much out of it as we do.
We really do. Your feedback and questions fuel the show, so please keep them coming. You can find us on all the socials or through our website at startupjazz.fm.
Also, a special thanks to our incredible production team behind the scenes who make us sound way smarter than we actually are. We couldn't do it without them.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode where we'll be looking at the burgeoning world of sustainable ag tech. It's going to be a great one.
Can't wait for that. Until then, stay curious, stay innovative, and thanks for listening to Startup Jazz.